Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Cada blanco de mi mente se vuelve color con verte, y el deseo de tenerte es más fuerte, es más fuerte.
Latin music star Juanes has sold millions of albums. Now he might become a crossover artist as a pop star ambassador in Cuba. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show we debate the role of the arts in diplomacy. And later, the New York-based group The Dustbusters pays tribute to the classic sound of 1920s-era string bands live in our studio. But first, the Miami-based, Colombian-born rocker named Juanes is set to perform in Havana, Cuba this Sunday. The festival is called Peace Without Borders, but it's not without controversy. Some see it as an opportunity to improve relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Others fear that cultural exchanges like this only reward the Castro regime. But this weekend's concert, along with a possible New York Philharmonic performance in Havana later this fall, raise larger issues about the relationship between the arts and government in foreign policy. Is cultural diplomacy potent or perilous? There's only one way to settle this, and the State Department never seems to use this negotiating tactic. We call it
Soundcheck Smackdown.
Two guests join me today to debate cultural diplomacy here in the studio. Lee Rosenbaum, she writes about culture for the Wall Street Journal and blogs as Culture Girl on artsjournal.com. Lee, good to see you.
Nice to be here.
And on the phone with us is Nick Gillespie. He's editor-in-chief of the political journal website Reason.com. Nick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, to both of you, we want this to be a spirited debate, so you're hereby granted diplomatic immunity.
Thank you.
Lee,
yeah.
Why?
Does that mean I don't have to pay my parking tickets either?
You can try that. You can try that as an excuse. Just don't hold us responsible if it doesn't work. Lee, the idea of music, arts as cultural diplomacy, is it a good idea? Is it potent or is it perilous?
Well, I don't think it's perilous at all. And I think the key is that it has to be cultural diplomacy, not cultural diplomacy. In other words, I think that the impetus and the programming and the decision-making should come from the artists and from the cultural organizations and not in service to a preordained diplomatic objective. That's where the emphasis and the beginnings should come.
So we're gonna slip a little bit of democracy on you in the guise of symphony orchestra from one of our major cities. That doesn't work, is what you're saying.
No, we're going to slip a little culture and a little information about our talented artists in our country. That's where the communication is, and byproduct may be lubricating relations and having a mutual appreciation among peoples.
Nick, sounds pretty good to me. What's wrong? Why would this be a perilous idea?
There's a couple things to consider. One is that when you're talking about appearing in, first off, the purest form of cultural diplomacy that can come out of the United States is the idea, or an extension of the idea, that we have virtually unlimited free expression in the United States, and that is our main export. Free expression and free trade go together. And we need to keep in mind the idea that if you're talking about culturally sanctioned events, or in a totalitarian regime or in a totalist regime, in a dictatorial regime like Cuba, most of the time you're going to be used as a tool of the regime that is in power, and that should be taken into account when you're wondering whether or not this stuff works. More to the point, though, the way that music and the way that culture gets used by dissenters and dissidents in a culture is rarely the way that governments or even performers want it. There's a reason why there's one of the revolutions against the Soviet Union and communism is named after the Velvet Underground and not under Van Cliburn, who was a classical musician who appeared every year, somewhere at Moscow's bidding, things like that. And I think that's worth keeping in mind.
Well, that's an idea that we want to, I think, come back to a little bit later on. Are certain forms of music, of art, more conducive to this than others? Juanes is not going to slip in anywhere. This guy has sold millions of records. Lee, he's hugely popular throughout the Spanish-speaking, world, especially here in the Western Hemisphere. And they're expecting over 500,000 people in Havana, Cuba. Is this, I mean, is he kidding himself if he thinks he can go there and perform in front of 500,000 Cubans in Havana and not have it have some kind of political overtones?
I don't think that this legitimizes the Castro regime. I think it legitimizes Juanes. I mean, it increases his fan base. It's all about him. It's not really so much about cultural relations. And certainly the Cuban regime is already very much in power and is not going to be bolstered by an artist appearing there. I felt the same way about the Philharmonic in Korea. The dictator there, he may have used this somewhat to self-aggrandizement, but it didn't really boost his power. It didn't have any effect on the geopolitical situation.
I think another way of talking about it is that the Castro regime, which in the 50s and 60s actually banned rock music and jazz music as decadent imperial Western American style music, it's a lagging indicator of the fact that they're losing control, that they're allowing a pop star to appear in this type of forum. Having said that, and I think that any artist should go anywhere that they want to, and they should play in front of whatever audience they want to, but it's similar to something like the Olympics, where, does having or sanctioning the games in a place like Beijing, does it cover up, does it legitimize a regime, does it give it new hope? I think that there's an argument that in a place like Cuba it does. I mean, the flip side is to say, okay, we shouldn't have any trade with them, whether it's cultural or commercial. I think that's a huge mistake. And again, to bring it back to the question of cultural diplomacy, one of the things that I find distasteful about, much when we talk about this stuff is when it's done through official channels, when it's done through a non-commercial route, and it's the U.S. government sanctioning something. I mean, The Economist talked about how the Obama regime has a relaxed travel restrictions in this case and in other cases. I mean, they should just get rid of it and let people and let artists actually communicate in a way that is more meaningful and will exceed any attempt to kind of control the meaning.
So let me ask you this, Nick. Are you saying that the Juanes event in Havana would be okay if there were no embargo in effect and he could just, on his American passport, get through customs in Havana, go and do a show without...
Let me put it this way. There's no reason why he should be granted passage there from America, which apparently he is, and then I can't freely travel there. I'm not saying he shouldn't take advantage of his ability to do that, but this is, when we talk about cultural diplomacy, it's wrong to, the main function that a government can do, and I think the main function that an American or a U.S. government can do in terms of actually liberalizing the conditions for freedom and suffering in the world is to be open to trade and truck with people and allow American citizens to buy and sell and travel to wherever they want. And the rest of this stuff follows. The U.S. government shouldn't be in favor of supporting culture in the first place. I think it's a mistake. It hurts artists, it hurts their independence, and it hurts their ability to express themselves freely in America. And I think it's a problem when you go outside. I think it's much better to do this in the marketplace.
Nick, are you saying that the United States shouldn't be supporting culture? Did I just hear you say that? I mean,
absolutely. I don't think that there should be taxpayer-funded subsidies for the arts. And I say that as somebody who participates in the arts greatly and who supports them privately. I mean, there are billions of dollars of private donations to the arts every year. And I say that because I actually like the arts. When you have public funding, you politicize the arts in a way that you give a majority veto over artistic expression, which I think is always very dangerous.
Well, I think that we need federal support for the arts. I don't think we need federal. I think we're on the same page when we say it shouldn't be federal control and that the proposals and the program should come from the bottom up rather than the top down. Let me just finish, please. in terms of whether you need to contact foreign governments in order to get permission for things, it would be nice in a utopian world if we didn't have to do that. But when we're dealing with countries with which we have very tenuous relations, I just think that, unfortunately, procedurally, that the federal government has to be brought in if you're going to go to North Korea or to Cuba. Maybe that one day will change and we'll all be one happy world together. And I think cultural contacts will help to expedite that. But we're not there yet, and it would be nice if we could just freely travel, but there are a lot of other political considerations that realistically have to be met.
And I also think that that's one of the reasons why, again and again, you see that the type of culture that actually ends up having an impact on dictatorial regimes and tyrannical regimes is almost never high culture or sanctioned culture, which, even if it's not emanating from an official government position, is in the elite sphere.
He's a pop culture figure.
No. I mean, that's, yeah, I agree. And it's different. And, again and again, historically, and both in the Middle East, in Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon, it's been vulgar culture. It's been pop culture and music videos that have had more of a transformative effect than any kind of high culture. Certainly that was the case in the in Europe during the Cold War and things like that. The things that people smuggled into the country and the people that the type of stuff that really transformed and radicalized people was usually pop culture that traveled through very unsanctioned conventions. So that's
in Russia
question.
It was the samizdat, you know, the cassette culture of Western rock and jazz and things like that. What about, I mean, we're speaking with Lee Rosenbaum here in the studio from the Wall Street Journal, Nick Gillespie from Reason.com with me on the line, talking about music and culture as a diplomatic tool. The New York Philharmonic went to North Korea last year. We are expecting any day now to get an official announcement that they are going to play in Cuba, possibly as soon as late next month in October. Should they go?
I think the way the New York Philharmonic did it in Korea was exactly the right way to go about it. It was initiated, programmed by them. They laid down certain conditions that were met in terms of American journalists have to be there, in terms of this thing has to be on the radio where other people in the country can hear it, and in terms of meeting the people, of having master classes and so on. The only thing they didn't achieve, I believe, is getting people other than VIPs into the concert hall. But I think that it was an excellent model for how to do it. And I would also disagree with Nick a little bit about the importance of pop culture vis-a-vis classical culture. I think that, you know, pop culture may appeal to the young revolutionaries, but I also think that the classical music has a more profound effect on people, a more lasting effect than ephemera. And I think the reaction of the North Koreans at the end of the concert in that country kind of attested to that.
It was a very emotional moment for those of you who didn't see the telecast or hear our broadcast of it. As you know, there was sort of actually having been there. You know, for most of the concert, the audience was fairly stoic, and then at the end,
I saw that in the television.
Let me suggest, and since we're calling this SmackDown and we're on a classical music station, that the New York Philharmonic.
So I have a home court advantage here.
The New York Philharmonic is as irrelevant to cultural change or political change in North Korea as it is in the United States. And I think it's, you know, it's great that they got a chance to do that, and I'm sure that the people in their misery in the audience were relieved for, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours. And that's all great and good, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that that's the motive force or an agent of change anywhere in the world. I'm curious, and I don't know. I mean, this could be certainly be the case. Did the New York Philharmonic go to apartheid South Africa in the mid-'80s or in the late 80s? Or did they say, no, you know what, we're not going to trade with a regime which we find despicable, which certainly it was, or to Pinochet's Chile or something like that. This, you know, I mean, one of the
I
was just going to say that one of the things that we should always keep in mind is that artists and people who like artists, like everybody in this call, you know, we always have these delusions that what we do matters to other people. And in a certain way, I mean, again, this is why the diplomatic part of this stuff, culture, people speak through culture. They speak through art. They speak through expression in all sorts of unpredictable ways, especially when they're heavily repressed or oppressed by a government. And it's very hard to know exactly how that's going to happen. But I do think with some certainty, we know that the official channels rarely work.
All right. We're speaking with Nick Gillespie from the political journal website Reason.com and with Lee Rosenbaum, who writes about culture for the Wall Street Journal and blogs as Culture Girl on ArtsJournal.com. And we want to hear from you as well. What do you think? Is it ever appropriate for music, for the arts, to be used as a kind of tool of diplomacy, or is that thing best left to diplomats? Can music do things that conventional diplomacy can't? When does it work? When doesn't it work? Give us a call. You can reach us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can leave a comment on the soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org.
Check out today's soundcheck blog.
Watching the New York Phil in Pyongyang, I had the distinct impression that this event would leave no impression until the orchestra's inspired choice of encore, an arrangement of the beloved Korean song Arirang. That reached the audience in a clear and emotional way. Still, that didn't mean these people were going to go out and install a democracy the next day.
For the rest of the story, visit the soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Coming up next, more of our SmackDown debate over cultural diplomacy. You're hearing an example of it in the background, the New York Philharmonic, recorded live in Pyongyang, North Korea in February of 2008. And coming up in just a little while, something quite different. The Red Fox Chasers had a hit back in the late 20s with this song. Now the New York group The Dustbusters are keeping their sound and their legacy alive, and they'll play in our studio later on Soundcheck. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our weekly Soundcheck SmackDown debate. Today, cultural diplomacy. This Cuban-born New York-based artist, Cucu Diamantes, will be one of the featured performers at that Peace Without Borders concert this Sunday in Havana, Cuba. And we want to know what you think about music and art as diplomatic tools. Leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org or call us at 212-433-WNYC. I'm joined again by Lee Rosenbaum, cultural writer for The Wall Street Journal and ArtsJournal.com, and Nick Gillespie, who's editor-in-chief of the political journal website Reason.com. Nick, you were saying before how, you know, high art, high culture, you know, a symphony orchestra might not be nearly as effective as the stuff, the pop music that kind of slips in unofficially into an otherwise closed country. You were asking before about South Africa. You know, back while apartheid was still very much the rule of the day in South Africa, there was this whole Ain't Gonna Play Sun City movement where, you know, a number of very popular artists who were invited to play in South Africa actually decided not to when they would have had the opportunity to do exactly what you are saying, which is to get in there and slip a little subversive music in on these people. I mean, what's your reaction to that?
You know, again, I think it's, you know, the artist should decide. And I mean, that's, I think what we all agree is that we want to live in a world where the artist and the audience can decide whether to show up or not. So it's a complicated issue. I mean, I think without going into a long argument that is specifically about the apartheid regime, because there are geopolitics involved, but there's a strong argument to be made that the American disinvestment in the 80s actually propped the regime up longer than if we had done a kind of full frontal trade assault with them. And it's certainly that's the case in Cuba. The American embargo of Cuba, of not allowing Americans to deal with Cuba, has been a total disaster. It hasn't done anything to get rid of the Castro regime, now in its second brother and, you know, fifth or sixth decade. And, you know, and
so,
all
so having Juanes and Cucu Diamante and people come sure. from the States to Cuba, couldn't that be seen as a kind of opening of a trade window of sorts?
It's conceivable. And I mean, again, this is, I think, distinct from talking about cultural diplomacy that is sanctioned by governments, or rather that is orchestrated by governments. And we had throughout the Cold War, there were a ton of cultural exchanges that the U.S. government and the Soviets and various other governments put together. I think this is a different case. There are questions, though, about whether or not what brings down a regime or what destabilizes a regime is rarely a concert that they allow to take place.
But I have to.
And I would go back to the idea that this is actually an indicator of shaking.
Okay, let's Lee is champing at the bit here, Nick. Let's give her a chance to reply.
I have to disagree with you that only pop culture and not classical music can have a transformative effect. I think that classical music hits people in a much deeper way, and I really think that this is a kind of lubricant among contacts. It may not have the revolutionary effect that you're looking for, but it may be making people see Americans in a much more serious, civilized, humanistic way than they've been demonized to be believing.
Cuba or North Korea. I mean, I think Koreans are going to be, when they see the New York Philharmonic, that North Koreans or Cubans are going to suddenly recognize Americans are not beasts. And again, if you love classical music, more power to you.
I think
no
this
question.
Is a taste problem. Yeah, let me ask
both of you about something we haven't mentioned yet: jazz. Although Nick, you sort of alluded to it when you were talking about official programs during the Cold War, the State Department with its sort of jazz. It's the program for sending jazz musicians around the world. How does that work for the two of you?
In the same way, I would think that Nick would also say, these discussions have to do with all different art forms. In the visual arts, which is what really I'm more specialized in, there was this whole series of detente exhibitions in the 70s, which were problematic because there was so much State Department involvement. But we see everyday cultural exchange where objects are coming from all over the world. The two Chinas are lending to exhibitions. Mm-hmm. And all of these contacts, I think, are for the good and get beyond the propaganda and get to people-to-people kinds of exchanges and mutual understanding.
Nick?
And that's what that's about.
Very quickly, one thing that is for sure is that jazz stopped being a legitimately popular art form almost at the same time that the State Department became its main distributor.
Well, I think a lot of people would dispute that.
Jazz is not a popular form like it was in the 30s or 40s. But more to the point, and I think this is true, is that, we live in a radically altered age where it is harder and harder for, anybody to control information, much less dictatorial or repressive regimes, or the American government, et cetera. And I do believe that the contact and cultural contact, just like contact through trade and commerce, are massively important in stoking people's sense of outrage and the need for redress. And I think we've seen this in the Middle East, one of the most fascinating developments over the past 20 years in cultures that are very conservative and are very gender-normed and all of that kind of stuff. There has been an explosion of MTV-style videos, which are waking up both men and women to the idea that you can live in a radically different world, a more individualized world, a more sexualized world, and that's having a real cultural effect. And it is about cultural exchange.
But it is also a slow effect. I mean, you still can be arrested for driving as a single woman in Saudi Arabia.
And it's also a generational effect. I mean, is that kind of culture reaching the broadest populace? It certainly has a certain limited, targeted audience, and I think that's another point.
Let's see what some of our Soundcheck listeners have to say. Our producer, Joel Meyer, as he often does, is curating the comments as they are coming in. What you got, Joel?
Well, opinions that we've been hearing so far in today's Soundcheck Smackdown are provoking some very strong opinions on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. We want to hear yours. Paul from New York seems to kind of agree with Nick Gillespie. He talks about jazz music, well, not jazz music specifically, but Sesame Street, Michael Jackson, pop culture, and its power to win people over. But Suzanne from the Upper West Side definitely has an issue. She begins, "Mr. Gillespie is totally wrong. I spent 5 years in the late 70s and early 80s working for a cultural exchange program in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War. We sent high school, college, and community groups to perform free concerts. Don't underestimate the power of music to reach people on a real level. It allowed our groups to achieve a level of closeness with the people that would never have happened under other circumstances."
Okay, let's see what's happening on the phones. Neil joins us on the line from Brooklyn. Neil, I understand you actually studied diplomacy.
Yes, I graduated from the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, and now I'm an arts journalist.
Uh-huh. So having studied diplomacy and now being an arts journalist, do you consider the arts and diplomacy to be a good fit?
It's a very good fit, and
why?
They can be very interrelated, but one has to have very realistic expectations. And one cannot expect the visit of the New York Philharmonic to North Korea or any other cultural exchange to change a government's policy. But at the same time, entertainment and culture can humanize somebody, a culture that a populace thinks of as the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And it can cancel out a demonization. It's a longer-term, softer type of diplomacy, not a policy-changing diplomacy.
Thank you for using the word long term, because I've been waiting for the moment to bring that up. Lee, the Philadelphia Orchestra went to Peking, we called it back then, in 1973, was followed by the American table tennis team.
Ping pong diplomacy.
Yeah, and we look back at that 2 years later and think, well, what was that? But then 25 years later, we look back and think, I see what happened.
Exactly. People in the audience at that Philharmonic concert may have been moved to feel, as the caller just said, you know, that we're not the enemy, that we have also a humanity, a common humanity. And the fact that the Philharmonic extended itself in this way, made this gesture, and clearly relished doing it, will have a subliminal impact, I think, on leaders in the future, and that's all to the good. We're not going to see, you know, foreign policy change overnight because of cultural exchange, but I think everyone recognizes the long-term benefits of it, except maybe Nick.
One of my questions is just that, you know, should South Africa have been kept out of the Olympics and various other kinds of international sporting and entertainment arenas, you know, during the height of the apartheid regime, which they were, because one of the arguments that we're making, and certainly North Korea is and the Castro regime is every bit as much as debased and dehumanizing as the apartheid regime was. So, you know, there's a larger question here of things become situational very quickly. I do believe that more exchange and more points of contact across any line is good. I do worry about cultural diplomacy when it comes out of governments. It does put limits on artistic expression, I think, because when you become an emissary, an official emissary for the U.S. government, that comes first before being an artist and before
I think we're on the same page.
Which is the ultimate message, I think, that America can bring to the world.
Is this, Lee, let me ask you, is this the problem with Juanes, that he may not think he's an official ambassador of the United States government, but he did get, you know, have to go through the State Department, had his picture taken with Hillary Clinton?
As a practical matter, there's no other way of doing it at this time. I mean, we have to be realists about what the situation is with these countries that we have very difficult relationships with. I do agree with Nick that it shouldn't emanate from government. There was a program in the museum world where the American Association of Museums and the State Department collaborated on a program where museums were supposed to present projects that met State Department diplomatic objectives, and I really objected to that. That's not the way the program should be initiated.
Let's take a final caller. Elzieta joins us here in New York. Elzieta, I understand you're a professor at the New School. What do you teach?
I teach political sociology and cultural sociology.
Okay, so what do you think?
And I'm Polish. And I've been there, when it was so, so important for us to actually did get to know Americans who were coming on very different levels, from small student theaters through poets, people who were simply curious, to the larger governmental kind of supported exchanges. I have to say, but I'm really very much in support of all that conversations you had, that it had to be that we have to create opportunity for people to meet each other, because we are empowering them by letting them know that they are known, and that they know us, we know them, and that, you know, that makes a huge difference in creating a small, private, but public sphere, not official. I saw the Korean performance. It was wonderful. I had a goosebumps, and I cried, and I thought it was great, and it was very important, but it is just first step, because that had happened in the official. We have to help the private sphere of private individual artists to
Let me ask you, Elzieta, as a youngster in Poland, were you able to tell when something was official or when it was not?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Everything which was official was orchestrated by the regime, by the country. And, you know, it was okay if the regime was kind of winking to us and saying, you know, look, we are showing you a little bit of the West. It was fine, because at the same time we were able to meet those people privately. Mm-hmm. And we were able to, in a way, and it's very, very important that you don't feel that you are abandoned by the rest of the world. That you are there, and people do come, and they are curious about you, and that we are not lost, we are not alone. That, however unpopular it might sound, I'm very much
no. That's actually a great. It's a great place to leave it, Elzieta. Thank you very much for the call, Nick. Quickly, New York City-based hip hop group called Vice Verse All Stars. We're hearing them in the background. They toured West Africa earlier this year as part of a State Department Lincoln Center project. good thing or bad thing? It's the lower, you know, it's that kind of vernacular music you were talking about, but it's coming through the State Department.
Again, it's not really the idiom or the medium as much as the context of control and dissemination that worries me the most. More contact is always better than less contact, but we should understand that the best forms of contact are truly free expression that works its way into a culture and not some kind of top-down orchestration, which is often very difficult to find out, you know, how it's happening. The CIA, for God's sake, supported Encounter and a bunch of other leading cultural magazines in the 50s without most of the people knowing. So,
well, it was heartening to hear El Dieta say that actually they did know when something was coming through official channels to them in Poland. Nick Gillespie with us from Reason.com. Lee Rosenbaum here in the studio writes about culture for the Wall Street Journal. Lee, Nick, thank you both for a really interesting Soundcheck Smackdown this week.
It was a lot of fun, John. Thank you.
And still to come, the bluegrass outfit the Dustbusters will share with us the music of an almost forgotten but once very popular 1920s group, the Red Fox Chasers. They'll play live. Tomorrow on the show, controversial gossip blogger Perez Hilton talks about his latest venture, a two-month music tour. Tomorrow on Soundcheck. Act like you're a wild one.